Today, what I want to do primarily is to go over what we have been doing from the perspective of one modern commentator who talks about all of Avraham's experience up to now essentially as an education in family. So let me review what the stories have been that we've talked about and then give you what Leon Kass has to say about them, because he really he makes a very interesting case about what the past several stories about Avraham have been about. All right, first of all, let's remember that Avraham starts out, of course, being told by God that you have to go. And although we don't know what Avraham does when God says, Lech Lecha, which is all the way back in chapter 12, we know what he doesn't seem to do. He doesn't seem to consult anyone. God says, go, and he takes Sarah, he takes Lot, and he goes. And also, Avraham is clearly himself the focus of this, and this has to do in part with a division that the Tanakh makes between men and women. This is, if you study modern feminist Bible criticism, and there is such a creature, modern feminist Bible criticism, what they will say is that the world of the Bible, because it's a patriarchal world, because it's a world that focuses on men, divides the world up into public spheres and private spheres. That's what patriarchal societies do. There's a public world, and the public world is reserved for men. And the private sphere is more complicated, but is primarily the women's sphere. When God says to Abraham, go, this is the public sphere, according to this idea, okay? So Avraham goes, then he gets involved, he brings his family along with him, which is also turns out to be Sarah's family, because they're sort of the same. He gets involved in various things, including a war, and then for the first time, he comes to Egypt because of famine and says to Sarah, please tell everybody you're my sister. She says, fine, or at least she acquiesces in one way. Pharaoh takes her into the palace. God strikes Pharaoh's palace with a disease. They're saved, and Abraham goes out much enriched by this because Pharaoh first gives him essentially a bride price for Sarah. Then there is the first episode with Hagar and Ishmael. Right? Sarah says, you need to have a kid. I'm not able to give you a kid. Have a child with Hagar, who's my handmaiden. I'm just reviewing all this so that we keep it all in mind, because Cass is going to try to put all these pieces together, as you'll see. Try to have a child with my handmaiden. Avraham, rather than saying, no, 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 my dear, that's not a good idea, I wouldn't want to do that, says, well, okay. And this is partly, I mean, God tells him, listen to what Sarah tells you to do. He has a child with Hagar, and surprise, surprise, all of a sudden Hagar and Sarah aren't getting along so well. Because now Hagar has a child, and of course that elevates her status, and Sarah is barren. So Sarah tells Avraham to kick Hagar out of the house. This is where God says, do whatever Sarah tells you. He kicks Hagar and Ishmael out of the house. They are saved, right? It looks as though he kicks them out essentially to die. They're in the desert. They're saved by an angel. God tells Hagar, return to your mistress, even if she's bad to you. That's where you need to be. She goes back. Then God tells Avraham says to God, you know, I wish Ishmael could be the child whom you would accept. God says, no, you're going to have a child with Sarah. Sarah doesn't believe it. Avraham doesn't entirely seem to believe it. But in fact, that's the promise. Then there's the destruction of Sodom. And then we come to the episode that we went over last time, which is a sort of repeat of Avraham saying, this is my sister, with Avimelech. Avimelech, though, is, unlike Pharaoh, a really good guy. He didn't want to do anything that was illegitimate. As soon as he finds out that Sarah is, in fact, Avraham's wife and not his sister, He gets very upset at Avraham and says, why did you do this to me? Why did you trick me? Why did you put me in this false position? And Avraham sort of apologizes and once again makes a tidy profit out of the deal and prays for Avimelech to recover because he's the one who wronged him and everything is fine. Okay. Any questions on any of these stories before I... Yes, please. Hagar is claimed by Islam as the ancestor of Islam. Now, it's tricky because Yishmael lived 1500 BCE and Muhammad came along 700 CE. So that's about 2200 years in between Yishmael and Muhammad. In that time, the only people that claimed descent from Yishmael were the Yishmaelites who disappeared a long time ago. When Muhammad, in the Quran, Muhammad says that he's getting from God the correct version of the Bible. So if you study, this is why, I'll come to it in a second. If you study the Bible, though, with an Islamic scholar, he'll say, well, this is wrong. This is wrong. This was wrong. The Quran gives the proper version of this, and this is the improper version. In fact, remember I told you I was going to call Reuven Firestone, who's a Jewish scholar of Islam, to come and speak about Yishmael and Islam. I did call, and I got a message on his machine. Dr. Firestone is on sabbatical in Egypt this year. But I'm going to get him when he comes back, because he's wonderful, and it would be very interesting for all of us to hear what he has to say about Islam and about the Bible. And so I will definitely bring him next year. Yishmael is claimed by Islam, but you can't trace a direct descent. This is why, by the way, I mentioned this before, but it's a very interesting thing. Maimonides, Rambam, who grew up in Islamic lands, he was born in Spain, and he lived most of his life outside Cairo. He never lived in a Christian society. He thought Christians were idolaters, right? He thought, you know, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, it sounds like idolatry to him. You walk into a church, you see a statue of Jesus. He thought they were idolaters, but he allowed Jews to study Torah with Christians and not with Muslims, even though he thought Muslims were monotheists. And the reason is because Christians accept the Torah as true and Muslims don't. So even though he thought Muslims were monotheists, he would not allow Jews to study Torah with Muslims, even though he studied philosophy with Muslims. So, yeah.
I've been puzzled about Ishmael almost the first time we talked about him. Since Ishmael is discarded and then comes and Hagar comes back, why the story in the first place? What does this story...
This brings us to our... So, here is Cass's analysis of what is going on with all these stories, because his idea is, remember, and I'm going to go back again, but this time I'm going to go back through the whole Tanakh, what we've looked at so far. God creates a world. There's failure after failure, right? Fails with Adam and Eve, fails with Cain and Abel, fails with the Tower of Babel. All of God's attempts to build creation fail. And so God says, I'm going to make a family out of Abraham and Sarah, and they're going to be my success. But what you discover, this may not be a shock to any of you, is that men aren't ready for family. Abraham wasn't made ready for a family. When people say, for example, as was made clear to me many years ago, I don't even need to say by whom, when people say all the good men are married, it's not because good men marry. It's because marriage is an education for men in family, right? Because most men don't marry having any idea what is involved in family. And this is obviously a vast, are there men that do and women that don't? Yes, but as a general rule, and remember that the Torah, like every book of instruction, has to speak general rules. It can't address every individual case. So Cass approaches this as, God realizes that in choosing Avraham and Sarah, what is necessary for God to do is to educate Avraham in what it means to be a husband and, with the Akedah later, a father, because otherwise there's no chance that the people are going to succeed. That's his idea. Okay? Now, then he has to try to explain how the various events fit in. And this is his, the first thing he learns with Pharaoh is that wives are not interchangeable with other roles. And this may sound obvious, but it's not obvious to Avraham. Avraham sort of feels, okay, well, for now you'll be my sister, and then presumably later when Pharaoh tires of you, you'll go back to being my wife. You can do this now for me, but then later we'll resume the wife-husband relationship. Because everybody else in your life is interchangeable in different ways, right? I mean, you may not be perfect, a brother may not be perfectly interchangeable. A child may not be perfectly interchangeable. But you have to start out by understanding that roles in the family you create have to be fixed. So Avraham doesn't know this. This is Cass's idea that he learns this with Pharaoh, that Sarah has to be treated in a special category. He can't ask her to fulfill other roles. Why he does that again, we'll come to in a second. With Hagar, according to Cass, he learns that since, and this is his word, since Sarah pushes him into a quasi-adulterous relationship, because that's what it is, right, after all. It is a quasi-adulterous relationship. And remember, we talked about this before. Cass thinks that this is revenge, because Avraham pushed her into a quasi-adulterous relationship. Avraham said, pretend you're my sister. So she goes to Pharaoh, and I say quasi because her husband pushes her to do it, so it's not an entirely adulterous relationship. It's not like she's sneaking out at night into the palace, right? Avraham specifically sends her to do it, but still, this is her revenge, right? You pushed me into an adulterous relationship. I'm going to do the same to you. It's sort of legitimate, sort of isn't. But here is where he learns that lack of exclusivity in a marriage will destroy its harmony. Avraham figured, okay, Sarah said it was okay. I'm not in love with Hagar. I'm just going to have a kid with her. It's going to be fine. But not only now has he learned that Sarah can't play any other role, he learns now that nobody else can play the role of Sarah. Okay, you with me so far? Then God gives him explicit instructions. That is, God says, you're going to have a son with Sarah. She's going to give birth to your kid. And now he knows what his destiny is. And yet, this thing happens with Pharaoh. Now, what does he learn? I mean, with Avimelech. What does he learn with Avimelech that he hasn't learned with Pharaoh? According to, and this is a really wonderful insight. Remember the difference between what Avraham does with Avimelech and what Avraham does with Pharaoh is Avraham apologizes to Avimelech. Remember at the end of this, he never apologizes to Pharaoh, but he does apologize to Avimelech. This is because, says Cass, Avraham has now learned for the first time that adultery is a sin. With Pharaoh, it was a mistake. With Avimelech, he learns it's a sin. And he learns that in part because of Avimelech's reaction. Remember, Avimelech is outraged that he would think that Avimelech would do this. So now Avraham has, from every different direction, and according to Cass, the point of the stories is, we might say, well, all these lessons are obvious, but they're not obvious. They actually have to be learned. And Avimelech doesn't come, and Avraham doesn't come from a society that teaches these lessons, right? I mean, he comes from a pagan, polygamous society where, in fact, women's roles are interchangeable, where there is no such thing as adultery, really, because you saw he's willing to pass his wife off as his sister without a qualm of conscience. But, says Cass, he has gradually been initiated into the ideal, which is monogamous, committed marriage. And that's what Avraham has to know before he can have a child. All of this has to be gotten out of the way or Isaac can't come along. Because once Isaac comes along, he has to grow up into a house where that's the case. Otherwise, he won't be able to reproduce it. Yeah. Yes.
There is no part of this that's about
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I agree with you. I think Beshert is a very nice romantic notion. I never, when somebody says, you know, I found my Beshert, I never say, oh, you know, nah, it could have been anyone. However, I do think that there are many different people that anybody could fall in love with, and that you shape your life differently depending on who it is that you end up marrying. And you're right, Sarah and Avraham find their way, create this together. And had Avraham married someone else, he would have had to find it differently, and the same with Sarah. But they are, this is, you know, this is obviously, they're building a look, when you're under the chuppah, there are two things I want to say about the Sheva Brachot. One of them very nice that I first heard from Jonathan Sacks, who's the chief rabbi of Britain, and something that he wrote. One is that, you know, you don't call people under the chuppah lovers. You call them Re'im Ahuvim, which means loving friends. Because that friendship is, that commonality of purpose is more enduring than the passionate love that brings you to the chuppah in the first place, right? And that's what has to endure. The one other thing I want to say is you also mentioned the Garden of Eden under the chuppah. And the reason you do that, says Sacks, is because for Adam and Eve, the other person was the only person in the world, which is how it should be, right? There was only one woman, there was only one man. Yeah. Yes.
So it's really a huge contrary that Abraham is not supposed to be our Messiah. He doesn't start at the very beginning. He's going to be Messiah
right
that way. But then where does Isaac fit in, since we get all the backstory of Isaac? Isaac seen in a higher way?
Well, no. No, because Abraham is the founder. It's true that we don't get the backstory. And we do a little bit get the backstory of Moses, but not so much. We get nothing about Moses' childhood. Right? After he's saved and he's brought into the palace, we know nothing about him. And not only that, but Moses gets a very undistinguished lineage. It says a certain man of the house of Levi went and married a certain woman, and they had a child. That's it. There's nothing famous about them. We don't know their names for the first six chapters of the book of Exodus. So there is clear, I mean, it is, I really do think that it is a good case for the construction of a character, as opposed to just Moses was born and was going to be superhuman. Instead, Moses was born and had to build. In fact, there is this wonderful midrash, which is a really interesting midrash, about a guy who sends a king who hears about Moses and wants to know what such a great prophet must look like. So he sends the greatest artist of his kingdom to go and find Moses and draw his picture and bring it back. And the guy goes and draws his picture and brings it back, and the king says, "This is a hideous face. It's an awful face. He's ugly. You must have gotten the wrong guy. Go back and find Moses and draw his face." And he goes back and he finds Moses, and Moses says, "No, that's how I was born. I wasn't born with a beautiful face, and I wasn't born with a handsome face. And I had to overcome what I looked like from within because I wanted to be something better than I appeared to the world." Now, that's the exact opposite of the way we assume heroes are supposed to be. So there is. I do think, I want to read one last comment, by the way, on this that I copied down from Cass. He says, Abraham has accepted with Hagar the need for a woman, and with Sarah the need for a partner. But only now, after Avimelech, does he accept the need for a wife. Right? He kept those two as though they could be separate, and now he realizes they're not. He said he is constructing a unit which seems natural for children, right? When you grow up, it seems natural that your parents are in a unit. But we know is arbitrary and takes work. That is, it's a little bit arbitrary. You know, if you hadn't gone to the shop that day, you wouldn't have met that person, and you wouldn't have gotten married, and you would have ended up marrying someone else. And then it takes a lot of work to both construct and keep together that unit, and it's not always possible. It's not always possible. Which is also true and worth mentioning, that it's 700 degrees in here. Which is also true and worth mentioning, and that is that the Jewish tradition in the Torah mentions divorce. So it's not as though the Torah is under the assumption that a unit must be for everyone, for always, forever. And in fact, that's consistent with what we say. The idea of a beshert can't really coexist very well with the idea that divorce can happen. But the idea that you construct a world, and that constructing a world sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, it doesn't always work for God, right? God tried with the Garden of Eden and it didn't work. God tried with the Tower of Babel and with Noah and it didn't work. The idea that it doesn't always work, if it doesn't always work for God, it doesn't always work for human beings. So it is a much more down-to-earth. It's like I remembered years ago when I first saw the movie Ghost. Do you remember that movie? The basic idea is I'm giving something away if you haven't seen it. But if you haven't seen it, it's still worth seeing. It's a beautiful movie, even if basically her boyfriend dies, or her husband. He's her husband, right? Her husband or a fiancé, whatever he is, he dies. And then he comes back to warn her and to tell her about her life and so on and so forth. And it's a beautiful love story. And then at the end of the story, she sees him go up to heaven, right? And I remember at the end of that movie, I was single when I first saw that movie, and my first thought was, I pity her next boyfriend. She's got, 50 years of life left on earth, or 60 years of life, and he's got to compete with an angelic Patrick Swayze. It's terrible if you think about it. And if that's the image that we feed ourselves about what love is, of course a real life love can't compete. How could it possibly compete? Because that's perfect. He's angelic and he knows everything about her life and he warns her and he's surrounded by this beautiful glow and he's a movie star on top of it, right? So, and he cries to Barbara Walters. So I remember that years later that there was this interview where they kept showing clips of where he was crying. That was a little off topic, but still. But still, it was in the Patrick Swayze file. I can't help it. The idea here that that in fact a home is something that you build and it doesn't always work is, I think, very powerful. And the fact that that is the Jewish idea makes Jewish marriage something where if you say to people, of course it doesn't always work, you have to work at it, and also sometimes it can't work permanently, you have what to stand on. Yeah.
Where is divorce mentioned?
It is mentioned, there's a get. What's mentioned is get, a bill of divorce. And while I don't have I don't know if I have it here, if anybody there has an Eitz Chaim, just look in the Eitz Chaim. In the index for a bill of divorce or get, and it'll tell you the exact verse. By the way, what is interesting is that the ketubah is not mentioned. Marriage contract isn't mentioned, but a bill of divorce is. And it's mentioned in one sentence. It just because it has to tell you how to divorce if you need to divorce, whereas presumably by that time there was already standard. In fact, the Talmud gives standard ways. There are three ways to betroth someone. We only do it one way today, but you know what the three ways are to betroth? Anybody know, according to the Talmud, what are the three ways you can betroth someone? Well, you can do it by document, you can do it by gift, you can do it by intercourse. I didn't think you'd get number three. That is, in the Talmud, there's no such thing as premarital sex, because if you have premarital sex, you're engaged. Right? So, do you see it in the index?
It's under get.
What verse?
There's four different pages. It says 447H, 1068.
No, try 447. That's the one in the Torah.
Deuteronomy
Kitete. What chapter and what verse? And it says, just read the verse.
I gave this man my daughter to my wife, but he has taken an
abortion. No, that's not it. That's not it. Here, you know what? Well, will you give me that? Thanks. Yes, that's it. Bill of Divorcement. Which verse is it? Or which page? What page? 1128. But it shouldn't be in the Haftarah. It should be in the Torah. Oh, there we go. Yes. All right. Let's see. Oh, there it is, 24:1. Okay, at the very top of the page. So it reads as follows. A man takes a wife and possesses her. She fails to please him because he finds something obnoxious about her, and he writes her a bill of divorcement, hands it to her, and sends her away from his house. She leaves his household and becomes the wife of another man. The latter man rejects her, writes her a bill of divorcement, hands it to her, and sends her away. And or the man who marries her last dies, then the first husband who divorces her shall not take her to wife again. In other words, if you divorce somebody, they don't remarry, you can marry them again. But if you divorce somebody and they marry someone else, then you're not allowed to marry them again. Yeah. But the point of that verse, by the way, is not to learn the verse, but it's to learn that there is such thing as a bill of divorce again. Okay. Well, emotionally. All right, first, in terms of economics, in the Torah, the woman was dependent on the man. That's why the ketubah is all about what the man has to give the woman, because the assumption is that she's the one who has to be protected economically, which is true in most of the world and was true for most of history, even though it's not necessarily true in our community, although sometimes it is. So in terms of the relationship, it varies a lot. It's very interesting. For example, with Leah and Rachel, it's clear that they're dependent on Jacob's love. And they don't have too much of an independent existence apart from what it is that they want from Yaakov. But when you get to the, when you look at the previous generation, to Rivka, Isaac's wife, Maurice Samuel wrote an essay once called Rebecca the Manager. She's the one who arranges everything. She seems much savvier than Isaac. She's the one who makes sure that Jacob puts the hair on his arms and gets the blessing because she knows what she wants. So I think that it's hard to draw a model because it depends a lot on the personalities involved. But having said that, ideally a marriage is a place that allows you to express your connection to someone else as well as your independent gifts that aren't necessarily tied to them. But part of the complication of all this, of course, is not just having children, but who your children are. Because one thing that parents don't realize before they have kids is what kind of parent you are depends on what kind of kid you have. You know, and different children will demand different things from different parents. So there too, and here also, but the idea of parenting and what it means especially to be a father has changed dramatically over the past 50 years. So some of the, I mean, this is a real issue. To what extent do traditional models hold in a society where the position of women has changed through lots and lots of different things and for lots of different reasons. But that's another topic, which is an interesting topic, but it's one obviously that the tradition struggles with, is that question. Okay, anything else on this, the building a family idea? All right, so Let's take a look then at chapter 21. We have at least a few minutes to begin and to talk in particular about the very beginning of this. Now, in our synagogue, when we do the beginning of the Amidah, the traditional beginning of the Amidah is Magen, you finish the bracha by saying Magen Avraham, okay? Magen Avraham means the shield of Abraham. But in our synagogue, we also say Poked Sarah. Where do we get Poked Sarah? And what does Poked Sarah mean? Look at the beginning of chapter 21. Vadonai Pakad et Sarah. Okay? Now, Pakad here is an interesting term. It means, it's often translated as remembered or noticed. Here they translate it took note of. It's also used with Hannah and Samuel, that God pakad et Hannah. At Hannah. Remember that Hannah goes and she prays for a child, and the priest Eli thinks that she's drunk because apparently silent prayer was not something that people were familiar with, and she was there going like this. So he assumed she was drunk because in the temple prayer was only out loud. Just as, by the way, silent reading was something that, in fact, we have a letter still from Cicero that's commented on a lot in studies of reading and histories of reading, where Cicero says, I received your long letter but have not been able to read it yet because I have a sore throat. It's because everybody read out loud, right? The idea of reading silently didn't apparently exist until about a century or two later. I think it was Augustine or somewhere else, the first time someone walks in and says, I didn't know what my teacher was doing, and he explained to me that he was reading without saying the words. You know, nobody knew from silent reading. Isn't that wild? So the same here, apparently prayer was always out loud prayer. And there didn't seem to be fixed prayer. Moshe Greenberg, who is a scholar at Hebrew University, wrote a really interesting book called Biblical Prose Prayer, where he studies every time somebody in the Bible prays. And the interesting part of it is that it's not prayer like we do. When you say to somebody, do you pray, you think, do you get up at a certain time and open a book and say certain words? But that never happens in the Bible. What happens in the Bible is somebody feels something. They want to pray to God, so they pray, which is the origin of prayer, of course, right? That's why the Talmud says explicitly that you can pray b'chol lashon atashomea, in any language that you hear, which means any language you understand. You can pray in English, you can pray in Hebrew, you can pray in any language you want that you understand. So Hannah was praying, and God, when it says God pakad et Hannah, it means God remembered her, and of course the child who's born, Samuel, becomes important just as the child who's born to Sarah becomes important. And the other reason that I think that it's worthwhile is this is the first story that we have, which is going to repeat itself again and again, of the barren woman who gives birth. Don't forget, Sarah is 90 years old here, right? And even if you think that the biblical ages aren't exact, the point is, she's a very old woman who assumed she would never have a child. And all of a sudden, she has a child. And that symbolism of, you know, which is also an agricultural symbolism of barren earth, right? That's where barrenness comes from. And that goes all through the Bible, is something that doesn't have quite the same resonance today, you know, where you go to Whole Foods. But for most of human history, if the rains came and the crops grew, you ate, and if they didn't, you starved that winter. So it says, also, God remembered Sarah ka'asher amar, as God said he would, right? Or as God promised. Vayas Adonai l'Sarah ka'asher diber. And he did for Sarah as he had spoken. So now all of, in some ways, the entire history of Abraham from chapter 12 to chapter 21 has been leading up to this moment. Now they're ready to have a kid, which is why I think Cass looks at everything from 12 to 21 as, in what ways was it preparing Abraham for this moment? And by the way, it even, although he doesn't, I don't think, talks about this, I remember a long time ago having a discussion with Elliot Dorff. He had just been studying Buddhist stages of life, right? Elliot Dorff from the University of Judaism. And he said to me, you know, in some ways it makes a lot more sense because first you have your public life and then you have your kids. He said they wait for men to have kids later after they've had whatever public life they've had because the way we do it, you have a child and then you make your career, which means basically you have a child and then you neglect them, right? I mean, isn't that what? But Avraham has already made his career. He already went through the wars, quite literally. He already made his fortune. He already, you know, faced God and already argued with God. There's really nothing left for him to accomplish except to have a child. So he's able, presumably, to focus on Isaac in a way that he couldn't if he were going to go out and make a living now, in a way that he doesn't have to. Yeah. No, it doesn't there, but it does earlier. Yeah. I don't remember where we get 90, but it does say somewhere. But I'll have to take a look at it. The other thing, by the way, is remember, and we always have to remember this, the whole business about chapter headings. There's no such thing as chapters in the Torah. Right, one sentence follows another. So look at the sentence that precedes the sentence that tells us Sarah is about to have a son.
For the Lord clothes fast every womb of the household.
Of Avimelech, because of Sarah, wife of Abraham. Avimelech takes Sarah in. God shuts up the womb of everybody, and then nobody can have children. Or as we discussed last time, it may mean impotence, it may mean lots of things. But the point is, nobody can have a child one way or the other. When Sarah is redeemed, not only are the wombs of all the people in Avimelech's household opened up, but so is hers. Everything is settled. Now, and again, if you want to push Cass's insight even further, you can say, now that Avraham is a proper husband, he's ready to be a father, everyone around him is better off. Everyone around him is better off. Which is, by the way, part of what the ketubah is about and a Jewish wedding is about. You know, the chuppah is supposed to be your first symbolic home. That's what a chuppah is. It's a home. And it has a roof, but what it doesn't have are walls. And the reason the tradition teaches is it doesn't have walls is everybody in the community actually has an investment in your marriage. The idea that it's just a private affair doesn't exist in Judaism. Everybody has an investment. Because, after all, a sound home makes a difference in the community. And as we all know, when we or people that we care about are having problems at home, it has an effect on people around them. How can it not? And the pretense that we make that it only matters about us is just not true. It's just not true, right? Marriage is, and that's why the ketubah isn't a romantic document at all. The ketubah is a legal document, because what we're setting up here are the foundations of society. We're not just setting up a private romantic arrangement. So, anyway, yeah.
I'm having a little trouble with Cass. What's his first name?
Leon Cass.
Yeah, because he's putting this forth as like the beginning of a monogamous thing.
Yeah.
Of course, Leah and Rachel came later, and the right. Whole lines of multiple marriages yeah. Came later, and it wasn't something right. Taken on by this family that held in that way. Plus, it just, the whole stories aren't really coherent to me, that he gives away his wife Abraham gives away his wife twice, and then...
Well, he's interpreting it as what does Abraham learn from each episode. He can't make the stories more coherent. He's just trying to figure out what does each episode teach him. The one thing that I think he might say about the multiple marriage is what I mentioned Joseph Telushkin once said, which is that it's true that the Bible shows polygamy, but it never works, right? It's true that there are a couple times where a man marries more than one woman, but it's always trouble. And the Bible clearly shows you that this is not a good idea, right? It doesn't work with Rachel and Leah. Quite the opposite. It's a complete mess. And it turns out to be a mess even to the next generation with Joseph, who, as far as we know, only marries one woman. So Moses, as far as we know, only marries one woman. So, in fact, polygamy seems to be fairly brief-lived. Is that a briefly lived in the Torah and also unsuccessful? So he could make a case that way. Well, once you get to David and Solomon, that's no longer the five books. That's a much later event. And by the way, they're kings. And we're warned in the book of Deuteronomy that if you have a king, the king's going to marry a lot of women and he's going to send your kids to the army and so on and so forth. As soon as you create such a grand entitlement, you're going to have problems. And that is exactly, I mean, the kingship broke apart very soon over egos and over power and... It's true. I mean, kings have problems with their families forever and ever. That's what Louis the 14th, who said towards the end of his life, as he was abdicating his kingship, he said, "Because I would rather be killed by my enemies than by my children." Because a lot of kings were killed by their kids, since after all, that was the only way to get dad's job, right? You know, you were pretty much shut out of the corporation if you didn't. You've been in another study group? Isn't that kind of like, I thought we just said that, right, infidelity was a sin. I'm hurt, but go ahead.
I have even a third of the Orthodox. I cover my back. In what we've been learning from Rabbi Feinstein,
yes.
When the clash of civilizations came in the 19th century.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Women decided to choose their own mate for love, not because of family reasons. And they wanted to have their own privacy. They didn't want to be so much part of the community.
Right.
So I think I'm wondering whether or not I'm overstating or elongating your statement of the chuppah necessarily being.
No doubt about it. Yep. Yeah, I'm not for a moment suggesting that anybody here is the same position as Sarah. We're not, clearly. I mean, look, I started the class by talking about feminist biblical criticism. This wasn't a big field in the Middle Ages. You know? It's a different world. It is a very different world. But part of it, and you can, by the way, you can understand from this one sentence. You can understand why there is such a field as feminine biblical criticism. What did Sarah feel about all this? We don't know. And even though the rabbis made sporadic comments here and there throughout the ages, there was not a systematic attempt to understand how she felt, for the reason, by the way, that it's amazing what you can discover. Oh, I'm so glad I remember this. I had a great moment yesterday with two kids from the religious school who are going to do a mock wedding for Rabbi Schuldenfrei and Rabbi Schuldenfrei, right? Who got married, and they're going to do a wedding in the religious school to teach the kids about wedding and also have a celebration. So the two kids came to me who are going to be the rabbi and the cantor, and the two of them were asking me about Jewish weddings. So, and they said to me, "What about the symbolism of breaking the glass?" And I said, you know, there's this symbolism, there's that symbolism, there's the other. And I went through three or four different symbolisms of breaking the glass. And then she said, the one who's going to be the rabbi, she said something that never would have occurred to me, but she said it because she's a kid. And it occurs to her all the time. She said, "I have another idea about what breaking the glass means." I said, "Okay, what's your idea?" She said, "You know, when you break a glass at home, which kids do all the time, they're always afraid of what their parents are going to say. the parents are going to get upset because the glass belongs to them. But now that you're getting married, you're making your own home, and you can break that glass, and it doesn't matter. Now, how great is that? I thought that was terrific. It never would have occurred to me in a million years, because I'm no longer a kid. But as soon as she said it, I remembered. But it's not part of my daily life, so I didn't think about it. And here, too, you know, as a woman, you can understand things if you think about Sarah that it didn't interest or occur to a man. And so the idea of feminine biblical criticism is we bring a different perspective. And you do, just like that kid brought a different perspective to breaking the glass, that I promise you, if I had spent the rest of my life thinking about it, I wouldn't have thought of that. But she's right. It's a great declaration of we make our own.
Yeah.
She is, it's super. I'm trying to remember her first name. She's probably 14. 14? I know. I think she might be ninth grade. She was not a Sinai Akiba. She's religious school. I'll have to find out. Is Natasha the older one? Yes. How old is she? Super isn't Natasha. Sarah, I think. Right, Sarah. It's Sarah, right. So, and it was and she's 14, right? Or 13? 13, okay. So, anyway, she's the understudy rabbi, she told me. Right, Sam Licker is the rabbi, but he couldn't make it for whatever reason, so she's the understudy rabbi. But you know, sometimes the understudy is a star. So that's what she told me, and I thought it was such a wonderful observation. Anyway, it was a good session. So the same thing here, which is, if you bring a different perspective to it, then you see it differently, which is why also you study Torah over and over again as you get older, because there's so much that changes about your life and about what it means, especially in family, but in every way. And there are certain things that you fix on that later on, just like there are books or movies or so on that you love, and when you revisit them, you think it's not, you know, not so great. And here, different things about the story of Abraham and the story of Sarah grab you.
By the way, it's 1717, where it says Sarah is 90.
Oh, thank you. 1717, it says Sarah is 90. Great. The covenant is about to be fulfilled with the birth of Isaac. We don't really have the time to do the birth of Isaac today, but we will do it in 2 weeks. Are there any, though, other comments or questions about any of the stuff that we went over? Yes. Right. Yes. Well, that is another thing. It's true. Once Sarah, and we'll see this with the Akedah, when Abraham takes Isaac up the mountain and takes him away, a lot of the commentators say this is when Sarah learns what she did to Ishmael. Because, you know, it is of all the impossible things in the world, there is nothing more impossible than knowing what it is to have a child before you have a child. You can't, right? And so Sarah knew that Hagar loved Ishmael, but didn't know what it was to send him away until the end.